Hello and welcome back, listeners. I'm very excited to be recording interviews again with college just wrapping up last week. Today we have on Professor Michael Klarman, who is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law, and we will be discussing his book, The Framers' Coup, The Making of the United States Constitution. I hope you enjoyed as much as I do. I've known Klarman's work since I did Weeple in high school, and I truly believe that his book, out of any that I've read so far, is the most comprehensive account of the founding and the creation of the United States Constitution. And with that all being said, I hope you enjoy the interview. All right, it's lovely to have you here, Professor Klarman. To give the listeners just a little bit of a background about your book, The Framers' Coup, could you explain the reasoning of the book and the three justifications that you give in the introduction?
I had the idea for writing a short book on the making of the Constitution for Oxford University Press, which has a series called Inalienable Rights. And I had written a book for them in that series before on racial inequality in American history. And there wasn't a book in that series on the making of the Constitution. So I proposed the idea. They agreed, but then as I worked on it, those are short books. I mean, I think they're 50,000 words, which is quite a short book. But as I worked on it and got interested in it and got into the primary sources, I realized that there wasn't a single large book on the making of the Constitution either. There were lots of books on particular parts of the story. So every generation has its own book on the Philadelphia Convention, and their books on the flaws in the Articles of Confederation, their books on the Anti-Federalists, the opponents of the Constitution. There's a great book on the ratifying campaign, and their books on the Bill of Rights. But there wasn't anything trying to tell the whole story between two covers. So probably foolishly, given that I'm not some sort of expert on the founding, I decided to embark on that enterprise. And I spent the better part of 4 years kind of working through the primary materials. I'd already read a lot of the secondary stuff because I taught aspects of the framing in my constitutional history courses. What I say about the contribution that I hope I've made is, first of all, as I've already said, there is no single book that somebody could go to if they wanted to understand the entire story in just a single volume. Second, I decided to let the primary sources speak for themselves, partly because I found them so fascinating and many of them were kind of new to me. So one reason why the book is as big as it is that I've tried to allow James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and so forth to speak for themselves when I had the opportunity to do so. And then third, I was trying to put a finer point on a revisionist interpretation that's been out there for over 100 years, which is that the founding was kind of a conservative counter-revolution against the forces for democracy and redistribution that had been set in motion or accelerated by the Revolutionary War. And I didn't claim originality for that interpretation. As I said, it's been there, but I thought I maybe could explain better how the conservative forces were able to accomplish what they did, both in terms of getting the Philadelphia Convention to write a constitution that was incorporating this conservative counter-revolution, but then even more interestingly, how they managed to get the people of the United States to approve that through a ratifying process that was reasonably democratic given the obvious limitations of the era. So that's how I ended up writing the book.
Yeah, you already touched on this a little bit, but could you give like listeners a little bit of an idea of the scale and scope of the research that was required to do this? Because I'm holding the book here, and in the book alone, you almost have 200 pages of endnotes. And it was fascinating reading through your preface, all the different resources and helpers that go into a project like this size.
So I come at this as a law professor who's also interested in history, and that's where most of my scholarship has been. It's combining history and constitutional law. For example, My first big book was on race in the Supreme Court from Reconstruction through the Civil Rights Movement, from the Jim Crow era to the Civil Rights Movement. So one thing that enabled me to do this, as I said, maybe some people will think I'm being falsely modest here, but I don't really consider myself an expert on the founding in the same way that historians like Gordon Wood and Jack Rakove, who've spent 50 and 60 year careers immersed in that era. I've read a lot of the secondary literature, and for 4 years I immersed myself in the primary sources, but I don't think that makes me the sort of expert that these other people are. One thing that's possible to do today that just would have been impossible 50 or 55 years ago when Gordon Wood was working on his amazing The Creation of the American Republic is that things have now been gathered into documentary histories, and those have been published online. So you can literally sit at your laptop and access almost everything James Madison's ever written. And that obviously wasn't possible for most preceding generations of historians. So there's a resource called the Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution. And then there are collections of papers, James Madison's papers, Alexander Hamilton's papers, George Washington's papers. And that makes it possible to do an extraordinary amount of research in a fairly abbreviated amount of time. The other advantage I have, again, I think this is an advantage that derives from being a law professor at a very affluent institution. I can hire a lot of research assistants to help me. Now, you always have to be careful about how you use research assistants. You certainly don't want to delegate any of the writing. I don't actually want to delegate the research in the sense that I'm not asking people to go and find things and summarize them. I'm asking them to do mostly one of two things. Either, say, for example, I've read Pauline Maier's book on ratification, which is a terrific book. And as I take notes on it, I am interested in what her primary sources were. So, the way I work is I actually dictate. So I read Pauline Maier's book and I dictate notes, and my assistant types them up and sends me a file, which then I have electronically on my computer. Maybe I have 30 or 40 pages of notes. Included in those notes are, she relies on this source for this, and I'd like to see it. So at some point, I have my research assistants round up this stuff for me, and they make me copies. Although today, I think I just use electronic files, but the time I was working on this book, I was still asking for photocopies. And then I just sit down with a pile of hundreds of pages, and again, I dictate notes. And I've done my own research, but I've saved myself a lot of time by having other people collect the documents. Then when I'm writing, I also want people to go back and make sure that I haven't made any mistakes. So when you dictate, you're always introducing room for errors because you might not dictate clearly, or the person transcribing the dictation might be confused by something you said. So my research assistants are going back to all the primary sources and confirming that I've got all the details right, I've got the capitalization and punctuation right, that I haven't taken anything out of context. And then they also might be asked to find additional sources that say similar sorts of things to provide additional support. The 200 pages of endnotes come from the compulsiveness, again, that gets drilled into you as a law professor writing for law reviews. So, unlike any other discipline that I know of, law professors tend to publish their scholarship in law reviews that are student edited. And partly because of that, there's a real fascination or compulsion with sourcing everything that you say. I mean, it's kind of a standing joke that if you say the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, they'll require you to cite something for that. And I guess I've internalized that compulsion. And so I have copious documentation for everything that I say. If I'm making an argument that, for example, one of the Antifederalist main challenges to the Constitution was that it was consolidationist, that it would concentrate too much power in the federal government, I'm going to cite, five or six Antifederalist essays that make that point. And again, that opens up a lot of opportunity to use research assistants to make sure that you've got all the details right in the way that you've sourced the documents that you're citing, right? It might be an essay by Brutus initially published in a certain newspaper that's then collected in volume 8 of the Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution at pages 12, 13-14. So again, a lot of room for error and a perceived need on my part to have research assistants check everything. That's a long
Yeah.
answer to the question.
No, definitely. My next question would be about how your job as a historian, how important is it for you not to use reductionist theories that create a sense of inevitability to the past, but understanding that the past is always usually contingent on a complex set of factors. For me, this is like the idea of the famous story of turtles all the way down, that no matter what your reference point is, that you're going to be taking some things for granted in your analysis of the past.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So one of the virtues that historians bring to the table is an understanding of how things that we today can't imagine having turned out differently very easily could have turned out differently. So it's hard for Americans to imagine that the Civil War had turned out differently and the Confederacy had survived long enough to basically wear down the Northern will to fight. And the United States was therefore forever divided into two nations, which might have developed very differently, might have been occasionally at war with one another. The best histories of the Civil War, and I'm thinking here of one of my favorite books, James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, are very good at recapturing the contingency. And if at any number of places, a particular battle had turned out differently, for example, Gettysburg, it might very well be that the North would have lost the will to fight, which would have essentially made victory possible for the Confederacy. Same thing's true about the Constitution. Our Constitution is so fundamental to Americans' self-identity that it's very difficult to appreciate that the Constitution almost didn't happen. And even after it did happen, it almost wasn't ratified. So, historians are good at recapturing the contingency, and there are various points in the story where I've tried to retell the story in a way to emphasize that things didn't have to turn out the way that they did. If the Federalists had not made an important concession at the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention, Massachusetts might have voted to reject the Constitution. If a large state like Massachusetts rejected the Constitution, that might have had an effect on downstream states like Virginia. If Virginia had not ratified, it's hard to imagine a union being successful without its largest and by far wealthiest and most powerful state. So I've tried to do that. On the other hand, I do bring a lawyer's sensibility, which means that I'm trying to make arguments and offer theories in a way that historians sometimes quite self-consciously avoid doing. So as much as I love Pauline Mayer's ratification book, she very consciously tried to avoid making arguments and help us come away with the lessons from ratification. And again, law professors in their scholarship make arguments. The arguments might just be descriptive arguments, trying to understand how a particular court decision came about. Or there might be normative arguments about how a certain legal controversy ought to be resolved. Obviously, if you're doing legal history, you're not so much making normative arguments as you are trying to describe what happened. But for example, in my chapter on ratification, I tried both to tell the story, to recapture the contingency, but I also try to make arguments about how the deck was stacked in favor of the Federalists, and they had a bunch of built-in advantages that enabled them to get the Constitution ratified, even though it's not obvious that a majority of Americans preferred the Constitution to some hypothetical alternative that might have been a little bit less nationalist and a little bit less anti-populist.
Talking about the main argument of the book, which you identify as the third contribution, the introduction, which states the Constitution was formed as, quote, a conservative counter-revolution against which Leading American statesmen regarded as irresponsible economic measures enacted by a majority of state legislatures in the mid-1780s. Do you view this as somewhat of a variation of a Beardian account of the founding? And could you maybe briefly explain then for listeners who Charles Beard was in his important book and the economic interpretation of the Constitution of the United States?
Sure, great question. Let's start with Beard. Beard published this important revisionist book in 1913. He would have considered himself part of the capital P progressive movement that was trying to make fundamental changes in American society and the American economy in the same way that progressives today would see themselves advocating. So, more control of big business, support for ordinary working people and their demands for maximum hour laws, minimum wage laws, protections for labor union organizing, demands for political reform to try to take corporate money out of politics, regulation of the economy through antitrust legislation, political reforms such as initiative and referendum to enable the people to legislate without going through their state legislatures, which they had believed had been bought by corporate interests. Beard's argument was that the Constitution really stacked the deck against that sort of progressive commitment to redistribution and limiting the power of big business. And it was stacked by a bunch of people who had a direct stake in passing a Constitution that would empower the forces of finance, the forces of capitalism, and in a way disadvantage ordinary farmers in the competition for economic survival. Beard's argument was very much counter to the traditional tendency of framer worship, that the framers were disinterested, noble souls who were trying to accomplish something great in terms of political theory, but certainly weren't trying to put money in their own pockets or even to simply advantage the economic class from which they came. Now, Beard's book was ambiguous as to how much he was accusing the framers of simply making a buck themselves and how much he was accusing them of representing and enhancing the interests of the socioeconomic class that they represented. Sometimes he seemed like he was saying these people had invested in government securities at the state and federal level, and the point of the Constitution was to enhance the value of those securities by enabling the federal government to impose national tariffs, to borrow money at low interest rates and pay off the national debt and assume the state debt and pay it off, which would result in a windfall for those who had bought these government securities during and after the war at bargain basement prices. I think subsequent historians, beginning in the 1950s and 1960s, demonstrated that the empirical basis for many of Beard's claims were simply not valid. I guess I've certainly been accused of being a neo-Beardian. I'm not accusing the framers of trying to make a buck. I think many of them were quite noble in their aspirations and their ambition did not lie in the direction of enriching themselves. Rather, they wanted to do something great, which would lead to them being honored by subsequent generations all the way down to the present day, which they accomplished. We very much do honor George Washington and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. However, I do think that because they came from a certain elite segment of society, they were very well educated. They tended to be reasonably affluent. Most of them were professional men, a majority of them were lawyers. They came to represent a certain elite view that it was necessary to create a powerful national government that could pay off its debts, that could promote international trade, and so forth. They naturally represented those views in what they did in Philadelphia, and there were a distinct contrasting set of views that tended to be held by ordinary Americans, debtor farmers, who had been at risk of going bankrupt in the 1780s during a time of deep economic recession when they were asked to pay higher taxes to pay off war debt that had largely been concentrated into the hands of a relative handful of speculators and who were demanding quick payment in hard money that generally wasn't available. And I think there were pretty respectable economic arguments for why government would provide relief at that time, just as there are good arguments during a national pandemic that arrives once every century for why the federal government ought to be providing relief in terms of workers' compensation, relief for people who can't pay their rent every month and are going to be evicted from their homes, relief for small businesses, relief for state and local governments that are going bankrupt because of the expenses from the coronavirus pandemic and their inability to raise the usual taxes during the crisis. The framers were not very hospitable, not very accommodating toward those arguments. They saw deadbeat debtors who were trying to get out of paying their sacred obligations. And I think that was the same view that many people on the right of the political spectrum hold today. And I think there are two sides to these arguments, and the framers were not particularly open to the side they disagreed with. And that's because they represented the views of the class from which they came. So it is a kind of neo-Beardian argument separated from the idea of just self-interest, self-aggrandizing actions by the framers.
All right, I want to ask you a normative question then about the level of respect or reverence due for the Constitution. Near the start of the book, you contrast Jefferson and Madison as having different dispositions on the level of respect required for a stable government. Jefferson, of course, is famous for saying the earth belongs to the living and not the dead, and is more in favor of each generation charting their path. On the other hand, Madison has one of my favorite quotes in a response letter to Jefferson, and the quote is, quote, "If the earth be the gift of nature to the living, their title can extend to the earth in its natural state only. The improvements made by the dead form a debt against the living who take benefit of them. This debt cannot be otherwise discharged than by a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvements," end quote. Between those two views of Jefferson and Madison, personally, what are you more inclined towards?
Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation they had. Madison saw himself as a Jeffersonian acolyte. He was about a decade younger than Jefferson, and Jefferson was very much his mentor. Jefferson regarded Madison as his pupil, his loyal his loyal ally, but very much a subordinate. Madison was always respectful toward Jefferson, but on this, I think it's fair to say he thought Jefferson was crazy. Jefferson's idea was literally that each generation would write its own constitution in order to control its own fate. And then he did an actuarial calculation that a generation consisted of about 19 and a half years. Madison respectfully disagreed, but I think Madison thought this was a crazy idea. He thought you needed to inculcate reverence for institutions and people like the framers. And it was part of Madison's basically conservative nature. He didn't trust ordinary people. He often said very insulting things about the idea that ordinary people should be consulted about something as foundational as writing a constitution. He believed in deference to your superiors. That was not necessarily superiors by birth, but rather a virtue and education. And but Madison thought it was crazy that you would write a new constitution every generation, and he thought it was crazy that you would defer to ordinary people in Virginia on an issue as important as ratifying a new constitution. There may be a certain, this is an issue where there are pluses and minuses on both sides. It's not a knockdown obvious winner in this argument. People have claimed that because the United States is a nation with so much racial and religious and ethnic diversity, a nation of immigrants, that we need something in common to hold that us together. And that commonality is the Constitution and a kind of reverence for the framers of the Constitution. The problem with that is if we start to believe that answers that were given to us a long time ago provide very good solutions to modern problems that the framers couldn't possibly have anticipated. I'll give you an example. So the framers gave us a United States Senate that was apportioned equally among the states and not according to population, which was an issue that Madison felt very strongly about. He actually lost on that. That was simply a compromise that was necessary at the time because the small states refused to go along with the Constitution if they weren't given equality in one branch of the national government. Now, Madison and Hamilton and James Wilson and others explained why there was really no good argument why Delaware should have this equal power in the Senate with mighty Virginia, even though Virginia had more than 10 times the population. That there was probably no good argument at the time. It was just the small staters insisting on something and calling the bluff of the large staters, saying, we'll take our marbles and go home if you don't give us what we think we're entitled to. Today, we have a US Senate where Wyoming, with fewer than 700,000 people, has the same two senators as California, with almost 40 million people. It's impossible to justify that on any kind of idea of one person, one vote. There are no good arguments for it, and yet we're stuck with it because we have this reverence for the Constitution, and the Constitution doesn't allow us to change that without getting the acquiescence of every state. I think it would be healthy if we realized that provisions in the Constitution that are nonsensical, that if they made sense at one point are completely obsolete today, if we just said, okay, this doesn't make any sense and we're changing it, and we're not going to let us be bound by the requirement that if you're going to change the Constitution, you need to get two-thirds of both houses and three-quarters of the state legislatures. That sounds like kind of a radical position, but I think it's kind of commonsensical. And so much of what the framers did, while disinterested and quite forward-looking, they couldn't possibly have imagined a world in which the United States was the sole remaining superpower, where international trade and interstate highways and an incredibly mobile population and the largest economy in the world and airplanes and space travel, they just couldn't contemplate any of that. And the idea that a structure of government they designed for a different world where there were 4 million Americans who played no role on the international stage, most of whom were subsistence farmers and spent all of their lives within a 20-mile radius of where they were born, when you didn't have airplanes, you didn't have railroads, you didn't have telegraphs, I mean, you didn't have anything in terms of modern communication and transportation, the idea that they somehow would have arrived at a structure of government that would make sense in a radically different world is just implausible. So on this, I'm with Jefferson that the present needs to control the present and not be bound by the dead hand of the past. And that means showing less reverence for the Constitution and realizing, in fact, we have the freedom to depart from it if we want. And this is, in short, an argument for why originalism is not a very sensible way to interpret a constitution.
Okay, my next question is a little off topic with the book. When I was rereading it again and thinking about James Madison in particular, when he shows up at the convention in Philadelphia, he's one of the most nationalist delegates there with his national veto against state legislation and various other provisions in the Virginia Plan. But much later in his career, when he's fighting with Hamilton over the bank, he becomes more, I mean, less nationalist, and obviously he joins the Democratic Republican parties. Why do you think his views evolved over time? That's something I haven't really considered before.
That's a great question, Luke. And generations of biographers of Madison and historians of the early Republic have puzzled over this. How did this great nationalist who favored this extraordinarily nationalist policy of a federal government being able to veto any state law? So if Boston decided to build a bridge over the Charles River, the national government would have the authority to veto that if they wanted to. How did he suddenly become a states' rights constitutionalist in the 1790s, who toyed with the idea of nullification in 1798, 99, who gave a famous speech criticizing Hamilton's bank proposal as unconstitutional, who argued that federal assumption of state debts was unconstitutional. What happened to Madison? So there are a variety of ways to explain this. The basic premise is just that Madison was an opportunist and he was no more consistent in his commitment to federalism versus nationalism as most politicians are today. On one issue, they favor national control, and on another issue, they're big supporters of state authority. If you wanted to make Madison seem not simply opportunistic and hypocritical, here would be the possible explanations. One, Madison in 1787 was wearing a different hat from Madison in the 1790s. In 1787, he was arguably a statesman trying to derive an ideal system of government. It's true that in Philadelphia, Madison didn't really behave the same way that other Southern delegates did, and even other Virginia delegates. He often seemed as if he had taken off his cloak as a Virginian and become a national statesman trying to do what was best for the nation. In the 1790s, he was elected by voters in Central Virginia to represent the interests of Central Virginia in the National Congress. So it's not inconsistent for somebody to wear different hats at different times. That's one possibility. Another possibility is the circumstances had changed in ways that Madison hadn't been able to contemplate. So Hamilton turned out to be much more of a nationalist than Madison might have anticipated. Madison's nationalism really boiled down to, I want a national government that can raise taxes to pay off the national debt, to hire soldiers for an army if we are at risk of war, to regulate interstate commerce and international commerce. That doesn't mean he wanted the national government to do things like pass tariffs to support manufacturing, to assume state debts, to provide bounties to cotton mills in New England. And with Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury making proposals, Madison suddenly realized that the kind of nationalist agenda that Hamilton had in mind was not necessarily what Madison had in mind. So they start to disagree, not so much over raising import duties to be able to pay off the national debt. Madison was fine with that. But when Hamilton starts promoting a national bank, when he promotes federal assumption of state debts, and then when he writes his report on manufacturers, which is this idea that the federal government should actually provide bounties to manufacturing, right? The kind of the equivalent of the infrastructure proposals today by the Biden administration. We're going to spend federal money on roads and bridges, but we're also going to spend money on things like childhood education, early education, and community college education, investing in people. And Hamilton wanted the federal government to do that, but he thought that there was a public interest in building up manufacturing capacity. So he was going to provide bounties to capitalists in New England to build textile mills. And that's just not what Madison had signed on to. So I think the best explanation is probably along those lines, that Madison discovered and was a little bit horrified by what Hamilton wanted to do with the federal government. Then also, and this is not completely separate from the first couple of explanations, political differences between the North and the South just opened up pretty quickly. And it wasn't so much about slavery as it was about different economies, different views about foreign affairs, different ideas about the importance of banks, whether you preferred a manufacturing commercial republic or an agrarian republic. And the North and South had lots of differences, partly because of slavery and the result that having a slave economy led to different sorts of enterprises in the North and the South. But there were also foreign policy differences. Jefferson and Madison were more hospitable to the French Revolution. Hamilton and Washington were more horrified by it. And so you just got these differences developing, and you got very sectional political parties and very sectional elections. The 1796 election, the 1800 election were very sectional elections in a way that most subsequent elections until the Civil War were not. So again, you have these developing differences, which finally manifested in different political parties. And once you're part of a political party, you start to develop differences from the opposition, which might not have been essential to the actual formation of the party, but by virtue of being in a party, you start to have strong views about particular issues, which put you in opposition to the other political party.
When taking a holistic account of the creation of the Constitution, how many of the provisions do you think are really just explications of universal, timeless principles? And then how many of the provisions do you think are really context-based and based on compromises between the different factions and interests? We talked about the manufacturing and the agricultural different dispositions between the North and South, the large and small states. So yeah, how would you consider how much of it is contextual versus universal principles?
Well, I think it's all contextual at some level, but you're exactly right. There are different levels of generality. So some provisions in the Constitution are directly related to particular debates that were going on in 1787 and might not be recurring debates. So Article 1, Section 10, which includes the Contracts Clause, prevents states from impairing the obligation of contract. And that is very much responsive to the state paper money and debtor relief laws of the 1780s that people like Madison and Washington saw as simply official theft, basically, officially sanctioned theft of the property of creditors. Some provisions are very specific to a particular moment in history. Congress doesn't meet until a year after Congress is elected. That's because of the difficulties of transportation. Congress meets in December because they assume that most members of Congress would be farmers who couldn't meet in the summer because they would be harvesting the crop. That's very specific to a particular time and place. Even the larger provisions, which are sort of, as you suggest, more aimed at timeless reflections on political philosophy, are still just at a somewhat higher level of generality. They want a powerful president because they diagnose the problems of the 1780s as being too powerful, overly powerful legislatures. But the particular balance of power between an executive and a legislature is always highly contingent. And I doubt that they would have thought, you know, it's somehow a rule of nature that you should have a powerful president who can veto congressional legislation, who has the pardon power, who is commander in chief. A lot of that was a reaction to the very weak executives of state constitutions, which in turn was a reaction to the power of the crown, which many of the framers had called tyrannical and had departed from when they wrote state constitutions. So you see a kind of point counterpoint development there. They certainly believe that there were principles of human nature, and they talk a lot about that in the Federalist Papers and in other literature. They believe, for example, you know, Madison reflecting that, you know, if men were angels, you wouldn't need government, that government needs to control the governed as well as being designed to control itself. They certainly believe that, you know, people were power seeking, that you needed checks and balances to prevent tyranny within government and so forth and so on. But even those reflections were influenced by their understanding of history. And there's a tremendous amount of discussion, not only in the essays about ratification, but also in the Philadelphia Convention. They have long discussions about the history of republics and the history of confederacies and what lessons we ought to draw from them. So all of it's contingent in some sense. The point I was making earlier is so much of it's contingent on a particular time and place. So, you know, the only reason the president has the power to make a recess appointment is because they thought the president was always on duty, but the Senate would often be in recess, and it, of course, in an era of very primitive transportation and communication, you couldn't instantly call the Senate back into session to confirm a presidential appointment. But in today's world, you could imagine senators voting by email or, you know, some secure communication system, so that there's no need for recess appointments because the Senate never needs to be in recess. And if the president wants to make an appointment, the Senate can convene remotely and do it, you know, via Zoom or so forth. So some parts of the Constitution are just, you know, designed with a particular context in mind, but that's true about the presidency, true. They didn't imagine a world with nuclear weapons where the president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world who can destroy the entire world by calling a nuclear strike on China. They didn't imagine a world where Congress would be regulating interstate and international trade, which would be as prolific as it is. And in order to regulate those things, you need to create administrative agencies with expertise that can regulate at a much greater level of detail than Congress could ever imagine. There's no provision for administrative agencies in the Constitution because they lived in a very different world where you didn't have modern economies and modern governments regulating the economy in the ways that are necessary, health and safety regulation, you know, regulating the telecommunication spectrum and so forth. So, you know, it would be crazy to think that they would have been able to design a structure with that very different world in mind.
Yeah, we briefly talked about this earlier, but can you explain the context of the debt under the Articles of Confederation? And another question on that I've been interested in. Who were the original owners of the debt? I know in the book you discuss how when many of the debtor relief laws were passing, the main people against it were the speculators who had the debt at a markedly lower price. But did it start out with the debt in many hands and then speculators bought it up and concentrated it later? Or how did that process work out?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you have both state debt and federal debt to finance the war. Originally, Congress had just printed money, but that turned out to be a disaster because the value of the money rapidly depreciated so that it was worth almost nothing. So then they started borrowing money, but they also used government paper to pay soldiers. If they bought, you know, if they bought linen to make military uniforms, they would pay for that with government paper as well. So a lot of the debt was held in the hands of ordinary people, soldiers in the army, people, merchants who had sold goods for the army, as well as, you know, traditional government bonds that might finance the war. At that point, you know, most Americans held debt, but what happened over the course of the 1780s is people needed cash to pay their taxes, or to pay the, you know, the mortgage on their farm. And so they started selling off the debt to speculators. And at this point, nobody knew. The federal government clearly did not have the taxing capacity to pay off the debt. And the states were often not contributing their fair share through the payment of requisitions from Congress. So people might think that it's a good idea to sell your certificates at 10 cents on the dollar because you didn't know they would be worth more than that. Then these are bought up by a handful of wealthy New Englander, mostly New Yorkers and New Englanders, who are going to make a fortune if the debt ever gets paid off at face value. Those people become very important lobbyists for government enhanced taxing power, and in turn for a constitution that will enable the government to enhance its taxing power. And then there's this debate, should the debt be paid off at face value, and should the federal government assume the state debt? And that's what Hamilton is really trying to accomplish in the first year as Treasury Secretary. He wants to set the financial footing of the nation on firm grounding. He imposed a system of taxes, mostly tariff duties, and he absorbs the state debt. So the federal government is going to absorb the state war debt on the theory that this was a common enterprise that ought to be paid for through common tax revenue. And so the speculators are now going to make a windfall. They're going to get paid almost 100 cents on the dollar, both for the federal debt they held and the state debt. During the 1780s, that was being paid for by the farmers who were being asked to pay these enhanced state taxes that were going to pay off the federal requisitions. But one thing Hamilton manages to do is by giving the federal government the authority to raise tariff revenue, which it didn't have under the Articles, and with the promotion of American trade, which expands rapidly, you can pay most of the national debt through import duties. And import duties are almost a form of luxury taxes. They're not regressive like land taxes or head taxes because it's mostly people importing European luxury items. And so the debt gets paid off, but the tax burden of ordinary farmers is actually much alleviated. And everybody's kind of happy. And the Constitution in the early years is celebrated because it's enabled the federal government to raise revenue to pay off its debt without saddling farmers with unbearable burdens that they were bearing in the mid-1780s. A lot of that is just a function of economic prosperity returning. It helps that France and England and then most of Europe is at war, which is a great boon for American farmers who now have markets that are very much demanding their products. But also, they created a federal government that could take advantage of that.
Gotcha. Well, going back to the title, Framers' Coup, how did they get so many nationalist delegates at the Philadelphia Convention? Because after all, the state legislatures, which would have the opposite views, were the ones appointing them. How much time did they put into nominating delegates? And did they actually think that any substantive reforms would come out of Philadelphia or no, given the larger context with the Annapolis Convention right before this?
That's a great question. So that's part of what I saw as my contribution, explaining both how they managed to write this very nationalist and anti-populist document, and then how they managed to get it ratified. Some of this was just luck. As you say, in every state but one, it was legislatures choosing the delegates, and the legislatures were not particularly nationalist and anti-populist. I think with some delegates, with some states, they were just choosing their most eminent citizens. So Virginia is sending George Washington and James Madison, George Mason, Edmund Randolph, the governor. And I think if you're just choosing your most eminent citizen, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to be choosing people who are both large landholders, very wealthy, but also people who have national reputations that were acquired through service in the Confederation Congress or the Revolutionary Army. So to some extent, if you've chosen to just send your most famous people, your most eminent citizens, there may be a bias in the pool toward nationalism and anti-populism. Then there's also the fact that some delegates who'd been selected chose not to go. So people like Patrick Henry, who turned out to be one of the leading opponents of the Constitution in the country, he turned down his appointment to the Philadelphia Convention by the Virginia legislature. And one reason for that, it may just be happenstance, but it may also be that Henry had no particular interest in what he thought the convention would do, which is add a mild taxing power and a power to regulate commerce, but not thoroughly revolutionize the national system of government. He didn't have much interest in mildly expanding the powers of the national government, but if he'd known what was afoot in Philadelphia, he might have gone to fight against it rather than declining to participate and then rallying opposition in the ratification campaign. It also made a difference that they closed the doors of the convention. I think that liberated them to take extreme nationalist and anti-populist measures that they might have been unwilling to take if there were newspaper reporters in the gallery taking down notes, because they might have been jeopardizing their subsequent political careers by some of the extreme positions they took in these confidential debates. Then finally, there was a critical decision made by the more nationalist and anti-populist delegates to simply go for it and try to secure the form of government that they thought was ideal rather than just engage in incremental reform. They believe this might be their last opportunity to accomplish something very significant. And they decided rather than compromising and just making minor incremental reforms they would push through as radical a reform agenda as they thought they possibly could, and keep their fingers crossed that they could manage to get the country to ratify it. That was a conscious choice they made, and it turned out, I think, it was a pretty significant one.
Yeah, carrying on, this gets into my favorite chapter of the book, which talks about the ratification process in each of the states. Can you talk about the inbuilt advantages that the Federalists had throughout the ratification process, and how that enabled them to eventually, obviously, get the Constitution ratified?
They had a bunch of advantages, and this was not some sort of conspiracy. Some of this was just happenstance, and some of it was they were pretty good political strategists. So in South Carolina, it's quite clear that the ratifying convention was so malapportioned in favor of the Eastern commercial interests that were overwhelmingly pro-Constitution that South Carolina ratified in a convention by a margin of 2-1, even though it's pretty clear to most historians that if you simply had a referendum of all the people who were authorized, who were enfranchised in South Carolina, they would have rejected the Constitution. Most of the population had moved into the interior and western parts of the state, but those people simply were not given fair representation at the ratifying convention. So that was one advantage. Second advantage was they managed to get the conventions to take place in eastern cities like Charleston, South Carolina, Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, Annapolis in Maryland, Boston in Massachusetts. And that meant that the Constitution was being debated in an environment that was overwhelmingly pro-ratification. Now, to the extent that delegates showed up at ratifying conventions undecided, they might be influenced by things like their perception that most of the local community, which was appearing in the gallery, because all the ratifying conventions, unlike the Philadelphia convention, were open to the public, you would have 1,000 Bostonians waiting in line during a January blizzard to get into the ratifying convention. And these people were almost universally pro-Constitution. Or even in the evening when the delegates adjourned to the local pub or tavern, again, they would be besieged by a local population that seemed overwhelmingly pro-Constitution. So that was a big advantage. Third advantage is newspapers. There were about 100 newspapers in the country, but they were almost all published in cities, and the advertisers and subscribers, which are the economic engines of newspapers, they were overwhelmingly pro-Constitution, and often newspaper editors would refuse to publish anti-Federalist critiques of the Constitution. That was a huge advantage. It would be like having a political debate today and you only had Fox News. You didn't have any representation on the other side. So anti-Federalists in many states just had a hard time getting their views publicized. Another big advantage is that most of the educated elite was pro-Constitution. That was true in almost every state except Virginia, where the elite was kind of divided down the middle. But what this meant was the most polished orators, the people with the most education, the people who could refer to great political thinkers and quote them in the original Latin or Greek, they were all on one side of the debate, and the anti-Federalists might have been a little bit intimidated, not only by the better oratorical skills and the deeper knowledge, but also just by the higher social standing of some of the Federalists. So that was another advantage. Just in terms of organizing, the fact that support for the Constitution tended to be strongest along the Atlantic seaboard and in cities was a big advantage for Federalists, because the anti-Federalists tended to come from the backwoods parts of the states and from the Western frontier. And in an era of primitive communication and transportation, it was simply harder for anti-Federalists to rally their supporters than it was for Federalists. And then the framers had designed one huge advantage for themselves in Article 7. So under the Articles of Confederation, to get an amendment, you needed unanimity. Under the Constitution, the framers had provided in Philadelphia in Article 7 that once 9 of the 13 states ratified, the new system would go into operation and the other 4 states would be free to join or not as they pleased. But that completely changed the balance of power of prospective holdout states, so that once nine states ratified, in practice, it was almost impossible for the remaining four states to remain outside the union, because if they did so, they would be denied federal military protection, they would be subject to trade sanctions, and they would be cut out of important decisions made by the first Congress. So that's in fact what happened. Once nine states had ratified, the last four states, including the very important states of Virginia and New York, where there was lots of opposition to the Constitution, those states felt like they didn't have much choice but to sign on to something that clearly was not their first choice.
Gotcha. Well, it's been great to have you on, Professor. I'll ask one more thing to wrap up. What was the biggest revelation or surprise in researching the book? And then another question I ask all my guests is, what are the top three books that you would recommend on the subject? So for you, it'd be on the founding or the Constitution, generally speaking.
Okay. Let me start with the second question and then work my way back to the first. So three of the books, it's hard to pick just three. Maybe I'll cheat and offer four. So Gordon Wood's Creation of the American Republic was written probably around 1969. It has stood up very well over time. Gordon Wood is, in my mind, the preeminent historian of the founding. Second, Jack Rakove, Original Meanings. Jack Rakove is probably our foremost Madison expert. He's written a lot of great books, including what was probably his PhD dissertation, which was a book on the Articles of Confederation. But I think his Original Meanings is his best book. And I think that probably won a Pulitzer Prize back in the mid-90s. Third, Pauline Mayer's Ratification, which was published about 2010. She passed away a few years after that. That's a fabulous book, really fun to read. And then maybe if I added one more, Woody Holton's Unruly Americans, which really influenced my revisionist view about the extent to which the Constitution's kind of part of a conservative counter-revolution. What did I learn that interested me? Again, I was probably struck by many things, but one was the extraordinary public-spiritedness of that generation. So I have a story I tell my students that's so striking to me because I have a hard time imagining something analogous today. So a delegate from Maine, which at that point was part of Massachusetts, travels to the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention in Boston. Now, given the state of the roads, given the weather, he's traveling in mid-January, at least 100 miles in the middle of blizzards, crossing streams where there's some chance he's going to drown. And he's doing this, why? He's leaving his family and his farm for the better part of a month, including the travel. It may be quite a bit more than a month. The Massachusetts Convention, I think, met on January 9th and didn't finish till February 6th, and add in a week or more of travel on both ends. If he's lucky, he's getting paid expenses. He's certainly not getting a salary. He's one of several hundred delegates. Massachusetts had over 300 delegates at its convention. He's representing his neighbors in Maine, and he's doing this because of a disinterested commitment to establishing a good form of government. He's one of several hundred people voting on whether to ratify a constitution, and he has no personal stake in this. It's hard to believe the national government is going to have much impact on his life one way or the other, but he thinks it's really important to represent his neighbors in Maine. Probably he's representing a few hundred people at the most. Compare that to Americans today, half of whom can't be bothered to vote. And I just think that level of public commitment is extraordinary. And we've moved so far in the opposite direction that I have real doubts whether it's going to be possible going forward to maintain our system of government, which does require some minimal level of public engagement, right? You have to vote, and to vote effectively, you need to be informed, which means you need to spend, you know, half an hour a day reading the newspaper. And I think most Americans are busy and not obviously prepared to do that. And to think about somebody undertaking that task for no obvious personal benefit just blows me away.
All right. And on that happy note, thank you so much, Professor Klarman.
Luke, those are great questions. It was my pleasure. And let me know if I can ever do anything for you going forward. I'm really glad you're so interested in this, and I'm impressed by your level of detail in what you picked up from the book.